In the middle of February, as New York watched Texas become crippled by a unique confluence of snow and cold temperatures that crippled their energy supply, leaving more than a million Texans without power, many New Yorkers asked an obvious question. With all the snow and consistently cold temperatures we get, could this nightmare happen here? To answer that question, we're turning to Rich Dewey, president and CEO of the New York Independent System Operator, which is responsible for managing the state's electric grid and its wholesale electric marketplace. Welcome to the show, Rich.
Hey, David. Thanks for having me. Good to talk to you again.
So, based on what's been reported and your own knowledge of Texas's electric supply system, can you give us a real brief explanation of why so many Texans went without power earlier this month?
Sure. Based on what I know and based on what's been reported, first and foremost, they had a very, very severe weather event, kind of a once-in-a-100-year kind of storm. So in some respects, it's very, very hard to predict those types of conditions. But on the other hand, some of what we're seeing in recent years, presumably driven by climate change, is the severity and the frequency of these types of storms are becoming more and more common. So, they were faced with a situation where generators, in part, had some failures with their own equipment, and it's been reported that they didn't properly winterize some of their facilities. And in other instances, they just couldn't get fuel. So natural gas is still the predominant fuel in Texas, even though they do have a lot of wind. But it was really the failure of the ability to deliver gas to the generators resulted in inadequate supply. So as the temperatures went down, the electric load went up, and the generators failed to deliver enough megawatts, and they were forced to shed load, which is selectively reducing some of the consumer demand. And that's really a preemptive measure to try to avoid a more catastrophic collapse of the electric system.
Is a situation like what happened in Texas with multiple state generators going offline and nowhere to turn for power possible here in New York?
I would never say it's impossible. I will say that we've got some protective measures that we've put in place in New York that are somewhat unique, not only as compared to Texas, but really for the rest of the Eastern Interconnection. One of those critical elements is we recognize that during periods of extreme cold weather and high gas demand, home heating and building heating gets the priority for that gas. So there are instances where gas supply to some of the electric generators could easily be interrupted and should be interrupted when you think about health and safety situations. One of the things that we've implemented in New York is for those critical facilities that we know are going to be needed to provide power to the load centers, they're obligated to have an alternate fuel. So in most instances, that's oil. So that the generators in and around New York City that are more likely or susceptible to have their gas supply interrupted, the rules that we have in place and, quite frankly, the incentives that our market provide have those generators equipped with tanks that have oil and they can burn for multiple days to continue to provide electricity even when the gas supply is down.
Those rules you mentioned, are those things that are enshrined in state law or are they passed down somewhere else?
So some of them are enshrined in the reliability rules that the New York State Reliability Council enforces. We go through a process of establishing, number one, inspection and audit criteria to make sure that those are up to good standing. We work with the generators to make sure they've got adequate fuel supply heading into a cold winter stretch. And there's also incentives. Quite honestly, one of the things that differentiates our markets from ERCOT is our capacity market, which provides financial incentives for those suppliers to keep their equipment in good standing and making sure they've got adequate fuel so that they can ride through those tough stretches.
And when you say ERCOT, you're referring to the Electric Reliability Council of Texas?
Yes, that's right.
Which has almost basically become shorthand based on how much attention this has gotten. Texas, the Lone Star State, is unique in this system in the way they really don't partner, right, with any other states in terms of sharing power or electricity. What about New York? Do we have arrangements with other states and other regional providers to ensure if our own power supplies went offline that we could get it elsewhere?
Yes, we absolutely do. The situation in Texas is they do not have electrical ties to the rest of the interconnection for the country. So they have taken somewhat of a go-it-alone approach, and that was a means to try to avoid certain types of regulation that the Federal Energy Commission could enforce upon them. In New York, we maintain tight electrical ties really to all of our neighbors, so to the ISO New England to the east, to PJM, which is the ISO to the south. We've also got good ties to the provinces of Ontario and Quebec, and we've got good power sharing arrangements with both of them, so or with all those. So if we ever find ourselves in a situation where our supply is tight, we can rely on our neighbors, and likewise, we can help them out, and we do quite frequently.
I imagine basically a lot of regional generators would have to go offline for that system to really fail then. I mean, it wouldn't have to be just New York. You'd have to see like New York, Massachusetts, and other regional providers go offline in order to see this sort of lack of supply.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, first and foremost, we go through an analysis, and we do this on an annual basis, where we look at what is the composition and the current performance of our own generating fleet in New York. And we establish requirements for our capacity market so that when we start the year, and we look at this seasonally, winter and summer, we look at them differently, but we make sure that we've got adequate supply within New York to satisfy not only the expected demand in New York, but also what's called the reserve margin. So it's sort of that buffer that we expect we need to have in order to maintain reliability. And even if we get to a point where we exceed that level, then we've got the ability to tap into any and all of our neighbors for emergency support. So it would have to be a fairly widespread event that would really affect not only New York, but every one of the regions on our borders before we got into that kind of a situation.
How do you calculate the capacity that you might need? Do you just say, this is what we needed the past 10 years, let's assume the same thing? Or do you try to build in, you know, like what you said, like a buffer? Do you say, let's go, 25% above and beyond that, even if we might not end up using it?
Yeah, so it's actually even more sophisticated than that. So we do.
You mean it's not just going, let's multiply it by 25% and add it on? I'm shocked, Rich. I'm shocked.
Yeah. You know, that was the convention of maybe 10 or 15 years ago, where you could use the past as a reasonable proxy for what the future was going to look like. But a couple of things have caused us to rethink that. Number one is a lot of these severe weather events are becoming more frequent. So the cold spells are colder and the heat waves are hotter. And we've done some climate system studies to try to project what the bounds are of those norms, those new norms, and predict loads that might be a little bit different than historically what we've seen. After we do that, we actually run through these simulation models where we think about the different types of generators that we have and the likelihood that they're going to be able to perform in the heat conditions and in the cold conditions. And that's really important when you start thinking about how the generation fleet is really transitioning. We're getting a lot more renewables on the system. We're getting a lot more solar and wind. And those generators perform at a pretty wide range of performance characteristics, separate and distinct from, say, a nuclear plant. So we model all of that into the system, and then from that we anticipate what the level of reserves we're going to need to start the year. And we update that every single year.
Do you guys take a carrot or stick approach to these potential, backup providers who are supposed to be ready in an emergency to ensure that they are actually prepared when you need them to, step in for those situations that you hope never happen?
Yeah, it's a little bit of both, right? So, from a stick perspective, once they take a position in our capacity markets, they embrace obligations that we put on them, which could include fines and penalties. So that's part of the provisions for securing those capacity payments. In the energy markets, we look at things like scarcity pricing. So when the conditions are absolutely the tightest, the real-time price for energy will go up, and that signals the increase in demand and the drop in supply. And that should incentivize generators to be ready, to have extra fuel, to have all their maintenance done, to be really conditioned to perform during those peak periods. and then they can capture some of those revenues. And that performance, that extra performance, by design, would help us stave off the kind of humanitarian crisis that ERCOT has seen.
It sounds like basically surge pricing with Uber drivers, incentivizing that to everyone to get in their car on Friday night because you know everyone's going to want to ride then.
Yeah, very similar, very similar.
So are certain power generators more susceptible to extreme winter weather conditions? Because in national media appearances, Texas Governor Greg Abbott has blamed his state's problems on renewable energy providers.
Not so much from the cold specifically itself. I mean, when you start thinking about weather patterns, a prolonged cold spell typically is associated with a high-pressure weather system. Now, those high-pressure weather systems don't generally produce a lot of wind from a weather standpoint. So wind power, it doesn't perform necessarily as well. From the standpoint of its ability, as long as the weather conditions are right, there isn't any specific weather-related issues associated with renewable power. And when you look at exactly what happened down at ERCOT, and I'm sure that there's more information that's going to come out as the investigations continue, it was as much a natural gas and fossil fuel system failure as it was renewables.
Is there a power outage scenario that keeps you up at night or haunts your dreams?
When you start thinking about the types of weather patterns that New York could be most susceptible to, of course, you got to reflect back to Superstorm Sandy and coastal flooding, and the notion that a lot of our facilities that are close to the coast or close to the rivers could be susceptible to flooding. And I know one of the things we did following Superstorm Sandy was we did a long, detailed analysis at resiliency. And a lot of those facility owners did things like, move their control centers for the plants up to higher elevations so it wouldn't be susceptible to the flooding. I know seawalls were installed in some instances to try to keep surge, tidal surges out. So some of those enhancements were made. And that's still something we've got to look at as sea levels rise. The other area which concerns us because our transmission system, our overhead transmission system, is so important to move power from upstate to downstate, ice is a big threat for New York.
When it comes to transmission lines, is that something where we should be making investments to, say, put those underground to prevent the potential outages that you kind of just outlined?
I think that's something we've got to look at more in the future. There is a tremendous additional expense to put them underground, so we've got to be able to come to terms with that. I think that we have taken into account a lot of the contingencies associated with transmission failure with things like the dual fuel provisions that I mentioned and thinking about build out of the transmission system. And that's something where New York State, most recently under Governor Cuomo's recent budget provisions, have given directives and provided guidance that NYPA, for example, should start building out priority transmission upgrades. And we're looking at some of even New York ISO's own selection of new public policy transmission solutions that increase the transfer capability out of western New York and also increase the amount of power that goes down through the Mohawk and Hudson River valleys. That continued build out of transmission will provide additional headroom, if you will, on that system. So any single failure would have less of a detrimental effect to the overall performance of the system.
You mentioned the winterizing issue with Texas and how they basically weren't prepared. And I've read that they basically, in a lot of instances, put off some of the more expensive initiatives that would have made them more prepared, not necessarily, completely safe, but more prepared for the type of event they faced. In New York, do we make any sort of incentive to ensure that we're making proper investments, even if they might seem like they're extravagant or, for a future that might never come? Or are we potentially susceptible to the same, penny-wise, pound-foolish view?
I think we've got a couple of things in New York that provide additional incentives. Texas does not have a capacity market. So, you know, all of the revenues that generators have access to are based on that real-time pricing. So they're probably less incentivized to make those big dollar improvements for a once in every 10 years type of an event. In New York, with our capacity market, you know, we can be assured of a greater level of resource adequacy. And resource adequacy is just making sure you've got enough iron in the ground, you've got enough resources to meet that peak demand. We can be assured of more of that because of the capacity market incentives and the obligations that come with it, including, you know, we've got a team of people here at the ISO that go out and visit the power plants on a rotational basis, but we hit every one of them about once every 3 years, making sure they're maintaining their equipment in a professional manner, that the upgrades that they've indicated that they need in order to maintain those levels of performance are done, and basically hold them accountable for for the upkeep and the maintenance of the plant, so that when we need them, we can rely on them performing.
Well, we've been speaking with Rich Dewey. He is the president and CEO of the New York Independent System Operator. Rich, thank you so much for making the time.
David, thanks for having me. It's good talking to you again.
You've been listening to the Capital Press Room, which you can take with you on the go wherever you download podcasts. Our engineer in Syracuse is Dave White. My producer in Albany is Tim Williams. I'm David Lombardo. Thanks for listening.
Support for the Capital Press Room is provided by New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals in education, human services, and healthcare.
Join us again for Capital Press Room, a production of WCNY Connected, Syracuse.